The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 25/August 1, 2022. On the cover is a portrait of a young woman. It's in black and white, so the gradations of color are unknown. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow inner border of white. Time in gray is in large block capital letters superimposed upon a gray-white background. The heading is Her Private War, First Lady Olena Zelenska and the Future of Ukraine. And this is she, Zelenska, not Ukraine. She has long hair. It's flowing behind and below her shoulders, parted in the middle. She's looking directly at the lens of the camera with eyes in, as I indicated, shades of white and grays. She's neither smiling nor frowning. She has a high collar on her jacket or blouse or tunic that looks to be in an off-white. It's lighter than most of the other colors in the portrait on the cover. And indeed, the first story is beneath the heading World Healing Ukraine. First Lady Olena Zelenska takes on the trauma of war. By Simon Schuster, Kyiv. The photograph was by Alexander Shekmenev for Time. Olena Zelenska, First Lady of Ukraine, got to bed late on the eve of the Russian invasion. Her kids were long asleep in the presidential residence south of Kyiv, a vast mansion of yellow stone that the family always found a bit too grand, bordering on ostentatious. They moved there in 2020 because the gated grounds contain a separate building to house their security detail. For days, Zelenska had sensed bodyguards were nervous. The talk of war, she says, was everywhere, just kind of hanging in the air. The government in Kyiv had urged civilians not to panic, but that had become harder as the Russians massed an invading force that surrounded Ukraine to the north, east, and south. Blogs brimmed with advice for would-be refugees. News programs showed instructions on what to pack while preparing to flee. On the night before the invasion, Zelenska made a note to get a suitcase ready for her family, but she never got around to it. Neither did her husband, Volodymyr Zelensky. President of Ukraine had seen the intelligence reports, satellite images, intercepted phone, and radio traffic, indicating the Russians were ready to attack, but he did not believe they would go through with it. And he did not urge his wife to get ready just in case. When they went to bed February 23, Zelenska says, she did not imagine it would be the last time they would sleep side by side for months. The Russian attack began before dawn the next day, and it split the first family, much like millions of other Ukrainians. Zelenska stayed in his compound in central Kyiv to lead the country, while his wife went into hiding with their two children. Her projects to improve the nation's education and health care had to be halted, as was her career as a screenwriter. Surrounded by soldiers, she was seldom sure where she would sleep any given night. But 10 weeks into the invasion, Zelenska emerged from hiding, and she has since found her voice as a wartime leader of a different kind. While her husband has focused on securing weapons and other support from the West, the First Lady has devoted herself to helping the country cope with its traumas, both collective and personal. In May, she launched a government initiative to make psychological support available to every Ukrainian. It has now begun training trauma counselors, setting up mental health hotlines, and tapping foreign experts for clinical support. The psychic toll of the war is overwhelming. Ukraine's health ministry estimates 15 million people, nearly a third of the population, are likely to require mental health care. Some 8 million have been displaced by the war, the vast majority of whom are women and children. The number of military personnel has roughly tripled since the start of the invasion to more than 700,000, and many of them are likely to experience trauma during their service. There could be enormous consequences for the country, Zelenska tells Time in an interview at the presidential compound June 20. If we end up with post-traumatic stress that goes untreated after the war, the Ukrainian armed forces will need help screening soldiers for signs of post-traumatic stress. Convincing regular Ukrainians to seek care will also be a challenge. When Zelenska, 44, talks about her efforts in the field, she often borrows the English phrase, mental health, because the concept's hard to describe in Ukrainian. We have a particular distrust for terms that include the word psycho, she says, in the muted gray rooms that now serve as her headquarters. Down the hall from the Situation Room, where her husband gets briefings from his generals, Ukrainians associate the practice of psychotherapy with state-run asylums, places that are designed to isolate the ill from society. A lot of that stigma, Zelenska says, has its roots in the Soviet Union, where generations of Ukrainians were raised to deal with trauma by hiding it away. The attitude, she says, with deal with it, get over it, and if you complain, you are weak. The trauma of the war began for Zelenska before dawn, February 24, when the rumble of explosions shook her awake. She got out of bed and found her husband in the next room, already dressed in a suit for work. Emotionally, he was like the string on a guitar, she says, taut to the point of snapping. But there was no fear or confusion on his face, she recalls. He was completely together, focused. They spoke only for a few moments. The president told her the war had started. He had nothing else to say, Zelenska recalls, and I didn't know what to ask. He promised to call her later that day with instructions on what to do next. By the time the president rushed out the door, the children were awake and seemed to understand what was happening. Kirillo, age 9, that's K-Y-R-Y-L-O, obeyed his mother with a quiet intensity, stuffing a few of his things into a little rucksack, some markers, a puzzle book, pieces of a partially assembled Lego set. His sister, Alexandra, 17, was in touch with her friends through social media, trying to get a better sense of what was happening outside. O-L-E-K-S-A-N-D-R-A, the sister's name. About 100 miles to the north, the Russian forces had exploded across the border around dawn, aiming to encircle the capital and overthrow Zelensky's government. From the air, Russian paratroopers were descending on Kyiv and trying to seize the airports. Ukrainian troops and volunteers were putting up a tenacious fight. At one point that morning, as the First Lady stood at the windows of the presidential residence, a fighter jet tore through the sky, flying low enough for her to feel the sound inside her rib cage. The security guards told the family they needed to go down to the basement. There was a risk the Russians would bomb them from the air. Zelenska and the children did not want to flee. When the president called, she told him they felt safer at home than in some secret location, and they did not want to leave their pets behind. Two dogs, a cat, and a neurotic parrot named Kisha. But there was no sense in arguing. The family's address had been made public in media reports. So the First Lady packed the family's things into one roller suitcase and they drove to the presidential compound to say goodbye to Zelensky. By the time they arrived, the president had decided to remain in Kiev. His team was busy setting up a command center in his office and in the Situation Room on the second floor. The farewell was unsentimental. The family did not even step into a private room to talk. They hugged in the hallway, exchanging a few hurried words while aides rushed past. It was a calm conversation for the road, she says. They were both performing for their children at that moment, trying to make them believe there was no reason to panic. Both of them understood the danger. Western intelligence agencies had warned Zelensky. The Russians were aiming to kill or capture him. The enemy has marked me as target number one, the president said in a video address the second day of the invasion, and my family as target number two. To minimize the risk of assassination, Zelensky and her children had to get off the grid. They could not bring along mobile devices or log into their social media accounts, which could be used to track them. Before leaving the compound, Zelensky posted a message on Facebook addressed to the people of Ukraine. Parts of it read like a plea to herself. Today, I will not panic and cry. I will be calm and confident, she wrote. My kids are watching me. Friends in Europe offered to host the family for the duration of the war, but Zelensky and her children were not spirited out of the country, nor were they locked inside some secret bunker underground. They stayed in Ukraine, but were forced to move around to stay ahead of security threats. You just hope you're safe right now, she says of her mindset in those early days. You do not know what will happen in 2 hours. The uncertainty gave rise to a habit of making the most of the amenities in the places where they were taken, she says, because you do not know when else you will have time and when you will next get to a normal shower. Due to security concerns, they were not allowed to communicate with the president through video calls. For weeks, they spoke only on secure phone lines, which had to be arranged in advance. Yet they saw plenty of him on television. Despite the difficulty of the topics the president addressed in his speeches, the nightly appearances were a comfort to his children. They could see that Dad was at work and looked all right, says Zelenska. There was some stability in that. But it was difficult for her to continue working. Her campaigns in the field of education, like a program to improve school lunches, had to be put on hold as schools around the country closed. Zelenska also paused her career as a screenwriter for comedy shows, which she had continued to do while serving as First Lady. Before the war, I could do both, she says. Not anymore. The first days of the invasion left little room for sorrow. It was too surreal and disorienting. Zelenska coped by wearing a mask of optimism. Soon, though, the adrenaline began to wear off, and the horrifying reality of their situation came into focus. The Russians had already swept across vast regions of southern and eastern Ukraine, and their tanks were moving southward to encircle the capital. Millions of Ukrainians were fleeing the war, including many of the family's closest friends. I understood that I may never see them again, all the ones I love, Zelenska wrote to Vogue in April. She had trouble reaching loved ones and could not figure out where they were, or even whether they had survived. That was probably the first time when I cried, the first time I let my emotions go. I just couldn't take it. By the second week, Zelenska and the children had settled into a routine. Kirillo did schoolwork and spent hours drawing. Some of his pictures worried his mother. Instead of the usual sketches of Batman and Spider-Man, he depicted scenes of war and destruction. Alexandra, whom the family calls Sasha, followed the news and helped cook the family's meals. The ban on using social media did not prove as difficult for the 17-year-old as her mother had expected. It was all right, Zelenska says of her daughter. It turns out her phone addiction was not all that strong. Over time, the security protocols eased enough to allow the family to access the Internet. Zelenska was able to track her husband's pronouncements and other sources of information about the war. The news they delivered, combined with the sound of air raid sirens, often kept her from sleeping. "It is a revolting habit," she says, reading the news at night. Millions of Ukrainians have been living that way for months, absorbing waves of dread and tragedy through their screens. One story hit Zelenska particularly hard. In early May, she read a few pages from the diary of an 8-year-old boy who had survived the Russian siege of Mariupol, a port city on the Black Sea that's been reduced to rubble by Russian bombardment. "My two dogs died," the boy wrote in one entry. "So did my grandma Galia and my beloved city." The boy's story brought home the depth of the trauma Ukraine's children are facing. Imagine how this child, or how this could affect the psyche of a normal child who was not raised for war nor taught to hate, the First Lady says. And there are thousands of these children. It will be a generational challenge to help them heal after this war, and Zelenska has tried to make that challenge her own. May 8, Mother's Day, Zelenska emerged from hiding to meet Jill Biden, the American First Lady, at a school in western Ukraine that had been turned into a shelter for displaced families. The appearance marked the start of a new role for Zelenska. She has since become a vocal and visible advocate for Ukraine's defense on the international stage. Much of her work has focused on empowering organizations that specialize in the treatment of trauma and connecting them with state institutions, like the Ministry of Health, that can facilitate care for people who need it. After more than 2 months in hiding, she's making up for lost time. Her days are packed with speeches, meetings, panel discussions, interviews. Her peers from around the world have offered to help. The First Lady of Israel, Michal Herzog, has helped Zelenska create training programs for Ukrainian trauma counselors. The First Lady of Poland, Agata Kornhauser-Duda, has worked closely with Zelenska to aid Ukrainian refugees. "This club of ours has been a big help," Zelenska says. "We understand each other." She and her husband still live apart, and Zelenska understands her family has little hope of returning to normal while the war rages. When they reunited briefly in May, the children clung to Zelenska, savoring the chance to hug him for the first time in months. "It was touching," the First Lady says, "but I can't tell you more than that." She only admits that they still see him most often on television, and they have not been able to return to their family routines of watching movies and sharing meals. In some ways, the separation feels appropriate. Millions of families have been divided in Ukraine. Like them, the Zelenskys will need emotional support as the fight grinds on and the casualties mount. Every day you read about them, you hear about them, you absorb it, and it has an effect, says the First Lady. "Each of us, including myself, have felt that our psychological state is not what it should be. After 4 months of war," she adds, "none of us are okay." This Healing Ukraine lengthy article, was written by Simon Schuster at Kyiv, with reporting by Mariah Espada and Simone Shaw in New York. There are a few photos here to share, featuring First Lady Olena Zelenska. She's celebrating her election victory in 2019. She's surrounded by people in what looks like maybe a library or a large assembly room. And then in the second photo, she's meeting with U.S. First Lady Jill Biden in western Ukraine in May. It looks like they're working on an arts and crafts project with children. More people surround them, and there are balloons and banners in the background. They all look like they're having a good time, the First Ladies, as well as the people assisting and the children. And then finally, a more somber photograph. Here, Zelenska is wearing black. I don't know if it's a pantsuit or a skirt suit, but it has a dark jacket over a dark top. She has her blondish brown hair here pulled back in a bun at the nape of her neck. She's standing solemnly alongside her husband, also dressed in black with his neatly trimmed facial hair and hair on his head. There are two soldiers in dress uniform standing at attention. Behind Zelensky and Zelenska is a very large bouquet of white flowers, and in front of them is a smaller bouquet or spray of springtime flowers, red roses, pink snapdragons, something purplish pink. I don't know if they're tulips or what. But anyway, Zelenska and her husband, which would be Zelensky, attend the funeral of former President Leonid Kravchuk in Kiev, May 17. The following essay is from the Time Off Movies column. It looks like it's three columns long. Can Any Film Survive the Jane Austen Police? By Stephanie Zakarik. And here's a photo. Looks like it's in a lovely glen or dale or woodland scene with large trees and lots of undergrowth in bright green. There's a young woman running in the foreground. She's in a long empire bodiced dress with kind of heavy, clunky-looking black boots. Her hair is long and tossed behind her shoulders. She's being followed by two little boys. One is carrying a stick, and he's in a hurry, and the other one looks like he has his arm in a sling and a kind of a pointy pirate hat on. I don't know if he's playing or if he really does have a disabled arm. Anyway, Johnson, as Anne Elliot, is outrunning small nephews and Austen purists alike. For nearly 200 years, Jane Austen belonged to anybody who had the good fortune to find their way to her books. Emma, Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, these shrewdly observed novels about manners and mores among the well-heeled English of the early 19th century, and about the position of women specifically in that world, are among the most pleasurable reading experiences any writer has ever given us. But around 1995, the year of the explosively popular TV miniseries Pride and Prejudice, of Ang Lee's elegant movie version of Sense and Sensibility, and of Clueless, Amy Heckerling's delightful riff on Emma, Austen's popularity, always steady and true, skyrocketed. Her super popularity had a downside. It bred a population of Austen purists who seemed to think they understand her motives better than even she herself did. Today, any Austen interpretation faces a tough crowd. That is certainly true of Carrie Cracknell's Netflix adaptation of Persuasion, whose trailer, when it dropped in mid-June, drew hoots of derision from all corners of the internet. Many noted with disdain that Cracknell's Persuasion looked like a comedy, a complaint with some merit given that Austen's final novel, released after her death in 1817, is a comparatively pensive, searching book. Her understated humor vibrates in the background, but it is hardly the main feature. Even so, the ferocity of the Austenites' possessiveness, fomented by a mere piece of advertising, is unbecoming at best. It's also dazzling in its lack of originality. The virulently pro-Austen brigade is really just a subset of the larger and even more annoying, the movie can never be as good as the book crowd. Movies are their own creations. the likelihood that a film adaptation can match with complete verisimilitude. Your own vision of your favorite book is like wishing a leopard could be an elephant. Unfortunately, Persuasion is not a great movie, not even a close to good one, but its problems are failures of filmmaking, not necessarily of adaptation. Cracknell, who has until now worked largely in theater, may make some choices that undermine her aims, but she gives no indication of being careless with the material. Her affection for it comes through. Dakota Johnson stars as Anne Elliot, youngest daughter of a preening baronet, Richard E. Grant, who's fallen on hard times. Anne is bright and sensible and kind, but neither her father nor her two sisters appreciate her. And at 27, she remains unmarried, with no prospects on the horizon. 8 years earlier, she'd been deeply in love with a young naval officer, Frederick Wentworth, Cosmo Jarvis, and he with her. But a close family friend, Lady Russell, played by the marvelous Nikki Amuka Bird, had urged her to break off the couple's secret engagement, believing the match beneath her. When Wentworth, now wealthy and well-regarded, re-enters Anne's family orbit, she's forced to pretend she no longer cares for him. This persuasion is peppered with anachronistic language, and the heroine often addresses the camera head on, confessing her thoughts and feelings directly to us, rather than allowing them to hover in voiceover Nowheresville. Though cheesy, those are not the worst filmmaking choices. They underscore the story's timelessness rather than defying it, but Cracknell stumbles in other areas. The movie score by Stuart Earle leans too heavily on the kinds of plinky piano passages, what I call tiptoeing elf music, common in romantic comedies of the 1990s, and generally used to signal a heroine is about to fall into a mud puddle or the like. And in one truly egregious example of dumb slapstick, Anne, with a smear of jam on her face, impersonates Wentworth to amuse her young nephews, not realizing he has just entered the room. Part of that sequence is included in the movie's trailer, and you cannot fully blame the Austinites for blanching at it, but there is still plenty to appreciate in this persuasion. Costumes are stripped down to an earthy elegance. Simple linen coats take precedence over the usual coy, big-brimmed bonnets. And we may have the success of Bridgerton to thank, at least partly, for Persuasion's inclusive casting. But this is the direction all adaptations of classics should be moving in. These stories belong to everyone. And if Johnson flails in some of the movie's jokier moments, she's subtly moving in its quieter ones. Both she and Cracknell grasp what is at stake for Anne. It is rare to get a second chance at happiness, especially after you've let others talk you out of following your own instincts. Johnson plays Anne as a woman who finally knows her own mind, which also means she is deeply in tune with her own vulnerability and fears. There is something else. Because of this persuasion, an astute 15-year-old Dakota Johnson fan might find his or her way to the pleasure of discovering Austen firsthand. Jane Austen does not care if we have studied the precise way in which a piece of wall should be gathered into the perfect empire bodice. In fact, she'd probably be embarrassed by all the overkill defensiveness on her behalf. She will live forever, both because of her die-hard fans and despite them. All she needs is for us to keep reading, and that is a legacy she ensured for herself, writing it into every perfectly considered line. Here's another review by Stephanie Zakarik, was it? Yes, only the initials are here. Okay, a couture dress brings a made-to-order dream with it. Watching Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. It's like stepping through a portal in time, not back to the 1950s, the movie setting, but to the 1990s, when sweet-natured, visually resplendent pictures like this were plentiful. In this adaptation of a popular 1958 novel by Paul Gallico, kind-hearted London cleaning woman Ada Harris, Leslie Manville, a war widow, falls in love with a client's swoon-worthy Christian Dior gown and vows to buy one for herself, even though the price is far beyond her means. With some luck, she scrapes the money together and treks to Paris, where she is at first rebuffed by the master's right-hand woman, a frosty chic Isabel Huppert, only to win over everyone at the house with her forthright warmth. This is a story about following one's dreams and then learning there is a lesson attached to those dreams. You might catch more than a perfume whiff of sanctimoniousness here, but it is rare to find movies that value the mere idea of beauty. And this one, directed by Anthony Fabian, does so unapologetically. For some of us, the words 1950s couture fashion show are tantamount to summoning a cat with, "Here, kitty, kitty," and Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris does not disappoint. The film was made with Dior's cooperation, and the featured garments are so gorgeously detailed, you might wish to examine them at close range. Manville's performance has a similar understated elegance. Her Ada is uncompromising, not just in her fashion sense, but also in defining her own happiness. If she has all the twinkling charm of the nighttime Eiffel Tower, she also stands just as proud in the end. Ada creates her own enchantment. The dress is just a red herring, albeit a gorgeous one. Here's a small photograph for Mrs. Harris Manville. A dress is never just a dress, even when it's Dior. Okay, this woman, who looks like she's dressed from the 50s, she's supposedly a house cleaner, but she has, of all things, a matching print dress and apron. I've never seen a matching dress with apron. It's a little tiny floral print with various shades of purple and lavender and lilac and green and yellow. It's like kind of a bed of violets with a few daffodils thrown in. And we see her only from the waist up. It looks like a plain enough dress with regular cap sleeves and a collar, but this deal with the matching apron is quite interesting to me. It even has purple piping around it. And then she has blonde hair, and it's kind of thrown up onto the top and around her head because she's got a headscarf over it tied in the front and at the top, I think, in kind of a makeshift bow. And that doesn't even match her dress. It's kind of a rosy beige. It looks like a pretty scarf, and it fits well with her blonde hair. But she's smiling, and she's holding up a garment. On her left hand is a ritzy-looking watch for a cleaning lady from the 1950s. It's round, and it has probably a brown or brownish-red leather band. But the gown she's holding in front of her is gorgeous. It is a strapless, I don't know how long. Again, we only see this featuring her from the waist up. So she's holding the waistline of the gown at approximately her eye level. And so the gown is dropping down a ways, but we can't see where it ends, whether it's floor length or tee length or knee length or whatever. But it is gorgeous because it looks like it's the background of it looks like a pale pinkish lavender orchid taffeta, perhaps, or maybe a satin. I'm unable to see the texture detailing. But embroidered all over this lovely pastel background fabric are sequins and flowers. We've got pink roses and white gardenias. These are, I guess, fabric, but it sparkles even in this photograph. These sequins and beads that are holding these flowers in place on this lovely gown just sparkle. And it's not like a gaudy sparkling thing that you would buy for a kid's birthday party. It's just subtle and understated and elegant and gorgeous. Okay, I'm flipping the page now, and I will read only a small portion of this book review. It is Time Off Books, and it says, C.J. Hauser is an open book by Annabelle Gutterman. And please note that this is an abridged version of this lengthier article. C.J. Hauser, H-A-U-S-E-R, has one of those faces. She just looks like someone you could talk to. And strangers tend to do exactly that, stopping her on the street or unloading their life stories on her on airplanes. It only adds to the phenomena when one day we meet in Brooklyn's Prospect Park. Hauser brings along her 6-year-old Bernese mountain dog, a gentle giant named Moriarty. Within minutes of setting foot into the park, a man approaches Hauser to tell her about the time he was attacked by a dog, and how the bright orange of Moriarty's harness reminded him of his trauma. Later, while we're sitting on the grass, a woman stops and shares the story of how she came to adopt her mutt. Hauser laughs off these interruptions, a part of her daily reality with and without the dog. I thought this was a thing in everyone's life until a friend was like, "You realize this is weird, right?" she says. Hauser's comfort with oversharing goes both ways. This is the person who wrote an unassuming Paris Review essay, so potent it went viral. The Crane Wife, published online in July 2019, told the story of Hauser's experience traveling to the Gulf Coast of Texas to study whooping cranes 10 days after calling off her wedding, and why she chose to end that engagement. The piece exploded on Twitter and was read by more than a million people. Now the 38-year-old author and college writing professor is set to publish her debut essay collection, named for her viral piece, July 12. The Crane Wife, which includes 7 previously published essays and 10 brand new ones, explores Hauser's shifting perspective on love in all its forms as she dissects her most meaningful relationships. If self-exposure and confessional writing is ubiquitous these days, what sets Hauser's storytelling apart is her ability to harness universal questions about love and the stories we tell ourselves and filter them devastatingly through specific visceral moments from her own life. She drills under her own skin, excavating emotions that are still, even in 2022, hard to talk about. "There are a lot of feelings in here," she says, gesturing to herself. "It's true of us all. My relationship to what to do with those, whether to feel them or shove them away, who to share them with, whether to share them at all. That was the thing that made me feel good or bad about myself, the thing that's fluctuated over time." After growing up in small-town Connecticut in a family and culture, she says, were not open to discussing the bitter or challenging parts of life, she is firmly in her sharing era. "I find it very soothing to put stuff on the table." The Big Lesson from Small Progress on Guns by Gabby Giffords. Giffords is the subject of Gabby Giffords Won't Back Down, a documentary presented in association with Time, which opened in theaters July 13. "I often get asked about what could have been if I had not met with constituents at a Congress on Your Corner event January 8, 2011. If I'd not been shot in the head, leading to partial paralysis, aphasia, and a decade-long journey to regain the ability to walk and talk. Would I now be a senator instead of my husband? What might have been? What I say in response every single time is, move ahead. We cannot rewrite the past with our wishing or our wanting. But the future? Now that's something we can play a role in shaping. We've been living through 2 years of a pandemic and are now watching the Supreme Court overturn long-established precedent. And yet, while we're collectively processing and coming to terms, we must not discount the progress we've made on the seemingly intractable issue of gun violence prevention. June 25, President Biden signed into law the first major piece of gun safety legislation in nearly 30 years, legislation that provides funding for life-saving extreme risk laws and community violence intervention programs, addresses deadly loopholes in domestic violence laws, and enhances the background check process for 18 to 20-year-olds purchasing long guns. The gun safety movement accomplished this despite our bitterly divided and partisan nation. 15 Republican senators stood up to the National Rifle Association and stood on the right side of history. No, this legislation is not perfect, but it's undoubtedly true that compromise and bipartisanship are preferable to inaction, the status quo, for so many years on this issue. The job of a legislator, by its very nature, is incremental, if you do it right. 10 years ago, when I founded Giffords, a gun violence prevention group, we spent months trying to pass a similarly narrow but impactful piece of legislation. The bill failed. We kept going. The difference between then and now is the movement we have built. Millions of Americans refuse to accept the status quo of gun violence being the leading cause of death for children. Millions of Americans believed something was possible. One of the lessons I have learned in the more than 11 years since I was shot is that real life is not as neat and tidy as our fantasy of it, but it's a hell of a lot more worth living than an unrealistic dream. Whether we are talking about legislation or the state of our country, nothing's ever everything we wanted. We compromise and negotiate. We make the best of difficult situations. We grit our teeth. We move ahead, as so many Americans do each and every day, trying to make the best of this imperfect nation. Abe's death could help realize the changes that eluded him, by Amy Gunea. And this will be about a page and a quarter. When Shinzo Abe, Japan's longest-serving prime minister, stepped down in 2020, he had not quite achieved what he had set out to. He resigned, citing poor health, but with dire approval ratings over his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, a struggling economy, and a flurry of corruption scandals. He also had not succeeded in his long-held goal of revising the country's pacifist constitution. Perhaps that is why Abe, who remained one of Japan's most influential politicians even after his resignation, was still working to write his legacy. Those efforts were cut short July 8, when Abe, that's A-B-E, was killed while campaigning for the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, ahead of parliamentary elections. I believe there were expectations from both home and abroad for him to continue to play a role in the international arena as a former prime minister, says Taro Kono, the LDP's director of public affairs, who previously served in Abe's cabinet, including as foreign minister. How things turned out is a tragic loss not only to Japan, but to the world as well. There are already signs that Abe's legacy may continue to grow, even in death. 2 days after the assassination, the conservative LDP secured 63 of the 125 seats up for grabs in the upper house of parliament, a better showing than previously expected. The election gives political forces supportive of a constitutional revision the numbers they need to succeed. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has promised to deepen parliamentary debate over amending the U.S.-drafted post-World War II Constitution, which renounces war. Abe had wanted to add a clause on the existence of Japan's military, the self-defense forces, to clarify its status. If Japan was invaded from overseas, it would be the self-defense forces fighting at the risk of their lives. But nowhere are they mentioned in the Constitution, Abe said just days before his death. I am committed to changing that situation. Although Kishida is viewed as more dovish than Abe, Japan's foreign policy is unlikely to see radical shifts with neighbors that include Russia and an increasingly belligerent North Korea. Tensions with China also continue to rise with growing incursions around disputed islands. Abe's death will lead to a changing of the guard within the LDP. No clear successor has emerged for the conservative faction of the party, which Abe led, and a tussle for its leadership is to be expected. The faction is the largest in the LDP, and running it allowed Abe to play kingmaker even after leaving office. Any future leader able to assume control of that faction would prove tremendously powerful. Kishida, who took office in 2021 and helped guide the LDP to victory in an election that year, heads a much smaller, more moderate faction. Before his death, tensions between Abe and Kishida had been rising. Kishida, who thanks to the July 10 result can govern uninterrupted until elections in 2025, may well enjoy more support than Abe did when he left office in 2020. Abe's death could also give Kishida freer rein to push forward his ideas. Although he will have to tackle a few issues on the top of voters' minds, like rising COVID-19 cases and the mounting cost of living crisis, Kishida will likely try to push forward a new form of Japanese capitalism, which he campaigned on. The aim is to narrow the wealth inequality that grew under Abenomics, Abe's signature economic policy. What is not at stake is the LDP's continued grip on Japanese politics, and radical policy changes are therefore unlikely. The party, which has run the government consistently since its formation in 1955, except for a handful of years, is really the only game in town, and the real policy debates tend to occur within the LDP rather than with other parties, says Christopher Johnstone, the Japan chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a think tank based in Washington, D.C. The opposition is in complete disarray, Johnstone adds. For example, the rival center-left Constitutional Democratic Party of Japan won around one-third the number of seats the LDP did in the recent vote. Even if Kishida desires to strike out on his own, some of Abe's views have become cornerstones of the LDP. The current prime minister has vowed to take forward Abe's unfinished business, including possibly constitutional reforms. We will inherit Abe's will and tackle the issues he had to leave unachieved, Kishida said following the election. And ironically, Kishida may be more successful in pushing through Abe's agenda than Abe would have been. Abe was a polarizing figure in Japan, even if he was the most powerful politician in the country. Kishida can say the same things, and it will go down better, says Jeff Kingston, director of Asian Studies at the Japan campus of Philadelphia's Temple University. Abe was largely absent from the public eye as COVID-19 cases ticked up and the pandemic wiped out many of the economic gains of Abenomics. Voters also grew frustrated over a costly annual taxpayer-funded cherry blossom viewing party hosted by Abe and accusations that he had granted special favors to friends and political allies. But though Abe's life was cut tragically short, the shadow he casts over Japan politics may actually lengthen. Yoshikazu Kato, a research fellow at the Rakuten Securities Economic Research Institute in Tokyo, says he believes Abe's death and this big election victory could be a trigger to realize Abe's longtime dream. That article again was written by Amy Gunia, with reporting by Chad de Guzman, Manila, and Mayako Shibata, Tokyo. New Corporate Policies Raise Privacy Worries by Katie Riley. In the hours after the Supreme Court ended the constitutional right to an abortion, several major U.S. corporations, from Dick's Sporting Goods to Meta, Facebook's parent company, announced they would cover travel expenses for employees who have to cross state lines to obtain an abortion. But companies' involvement in their employees' abortion care raises a host of new legal and privacy issues. And abortion rights advocates are frustrated that pregnant people in states where abortion is illegal or heavily restricted will have to depend on employers as they navigate complex health decisions. This is a policy failure. This is a systemic failure, says Erica Seth Davies, CEO of RIA Ventures, or RIA Ventures, a fund focused on reproductive health. There's still a lot of uncertainty about what these policies will mean for employees, whether benefits will be managed by health insurance providers or human resources departments, and how employees' privacy will be protected. The end of Roe v. Wade has also given rise to new concerns about how sensitive data could be exploited in states that pass laws with civil or criminal penalties for people who seek an abortion and those who offer help. Kate Spector Baghdadi, a lawyer and bioethicist at the University of Michigan Medical School, says companies need to prioritize data privacy as much as possible. When we are talking about telling your employer you're going to get an abortion, and the employer giving you cash to support that decision, that's far outside any scope of protected health data, she says. Also, I fear, opens women up to additional layers of potential discrimination. This edition of Time includes a whole bunch of what Time considers the world's greatest places, so I will read a few of these to you until we run out of time. Miami, so hot right now, by Stacy Lostow. Miami's emerging as the U.S.'s capital of cool. The inaugural Miami Grand Prix in May drew a spectacular cross-section of VIPs and celebrities to witness Formula One stateside, making the city feel, according to ESPN, like the center of the sporting universe. To soak up the sun, the Underline is a new outdoor park on the city's riverfront, opening in phases through 2025. The first section is Brickell Backyard, a half-mile stretch of bike paths and public spaces, think yoga and live music, underneath the Miami Metro Rail, which just won Architizer's A-plus award for architecture and urban transformation. Then there's the avalanche of hotel openings in the past several months, including the playful Moxie Miami South Beach, the dual-branded AC Hotel by Marriott and Element by Westin in Brickell. The two share a fitness center and a rooftop pool. And the Art Deco Gabriel South Beach Curio Collection by Hilton, which is powered exclusively by renewable energy. Uma House, South Beach, near the Convention Center, and Esme Hotel, with its village of bars and restaurants on Española Way, round out the city's openings for visitors looking for posh playfulness. Satuchi Islands, Japan, immersed in art by Kathleen Relihan. While the Venice Biennale may get more buzz, the Satuchi Triennial, held every 3 years since 2010, is arguably more distinctive. Spread out over 14 locations and 3 seasonal sessions from April to November, the world-class art festival has revitalized this cluster of rural islands in Japan's Seto Inland Sea, or maybe that's Seto, S-E-T-O, which suffered from a shrinking population. Now abandoned elementary schools and homes exhibit works by James Turrell and others, and old fishing boats are turned into large-scale art installations. Japan's own 93-year-old pop art icon, Yayoi Kusama, put these islands on the art map with her enormous yellow polka dot pumpkin, now removed because of damage from a typhoon. It had been housed at the Benes House Museum, a museum hotel designed by Tadao Ando that is an ideal escape for art lovers. Also designed by Ando, the Valley Gallery opened at Naoshima this year and exhibits Kusama's Narcissus Garden Steel Balls installation. The newly opened Ryokan Roka, a luxury inn that doubles as an art gallery and incubator for emerging artists, honors local culture with open-air onsens, hot springs in all 11 suites. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.